The Daily Connect Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Connect Podcast for Friday, the 14th of September, 2018. Stephen Scott back with you again. And coming up, we are going to be in the forum. Ian Beverley and Joe Fishwick will be joining me to talk about a whole wide range of topics, including disabled toilets and employment and, well, lots more besides. Keep listening to find out more. Also, Natalie Swadeska joins us to talk about the RNIB Quick Poll, which this week is all about dockless bikes. And Chris Wallace is here with something for the weekend. Can't wait for that. He's got some brilliant ideas for you for either things you can go along to that you can sit at home and listen to or whatever. That's coming up on Something for the Weekend shortly. But first, let's find out more about the rebrand of RNIB. Our own Ian Wilson is on the case.
RNIB this week launched its rebrand with a new look, new logo and a new message to the British public. It comes as the charity celebrates its 150th year. And here to talk about it a little more is RNIB Director of Relationships, Sophie Castell. Sophie, thank you very much, first of all, for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio. Can you tell us, first of all, about the changes that have been made, please?
Well, the rebrand project has a number of elements to it, and I suppose the most obvious changes will be to what we call our brand identity. So the logo, colours we're using, and how we're presenting ourselves to the outside world. But I think the important thing to realise is that a brand is not just a logo. A brand is a very precious thing for any organisation. It's about our reputation, and it's about how we are perceived in the outside world. I think a couple of quotes help with that. The brand being what people say about you when you're not in the room. And then there's another favourite quote of mine, which is a brand is a promise and a strong brand is a promise kept. So this rebrand is more than just a logo. We've been developing the new RNIB strategy, thinking more about how in the 21st century we support blind and sighted people. And so the rebrand is really about expressing that, about our desire to be a real catalyst for change and really create a world where there are no barriers for blind and partially sighted people.
So that's what you want the rebrand to achieve. How do you think RNIB is currently perceived by the public?
Well, we obviously hear from blind and partially sighted people and the wider public every day. We know from research amongst the wider public that we're perceived as quite sort of corporate-looking, a bit cold and distant, a bit institutional. So we know that there are some perceptions around that. And so, you know, this rebrand, as I say, is partly meant to express what we want to be seen in terms of how we're supporting blind and sighted side of people, and also to make us feel a little bit more modern and fresh and get rid of some of those more negative perceptions.
How difficult is it, Sophie, to focus public attention on a charity these days?
Oh, that's a really good question. A lot of charities have a really important place in the hearts and minds of the British public. You know, we're an amazing country in that regard. You know, lots of people give a lot of money to charities. You know, we are a country that's very well known for our voluntary giving. In that sense, you know, people want to hear from charities. I think that's true. I think, though, it can be difficult sometimes for charity messages to stand out, to be sticky in the public's mind, partly because there are a lot of charities, partly because, you know, there are a lot of good causes, and partly because just in this modern world, there are so many communication channels. You know, we've got digital, there's TV, there's radio, print channels. So although I think, you know, the public are very interested in charity messages, it is a very, very busy sort of environment for getting those messages across.
I'll put a point to you, Sophie. Blind, partially sighted people, I know they were involved in giving you information and ideas and suggestions about the new brand itself, a new logo, etc. Some people might argue perhaps that the money involved in this could be better spent. How would you respond to that?
Well, let me just talk a little bit first about how we involve people, because I think that's actually been a critical part of this whole process. So I joined RNIB roughly a year ago. It was very clear to me that doing this rebrand is going to be an important project for us. And I am very, very personally committed to involving people in this part of development process. And so we started off with working with the designer, with blind and partially sighted people, with a range of different sight conditions, to work through how we could get the most legible, the most readable, accessible design. And that wasn't done by the designer sitting in his little studio and then coming out and showing people work. It was done very, very co-productively. So blind and partially sighted people were involved right from the word go. And I think you can see that in the results. So that the typeface is very clear. Things like the bottom of the B in RNIB is slightly bigger than the top, and that's to make sure that it doesn't get confused with an H. So we did this very, very bold process all the way through. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that the process we've gone through is very much about putting the community of blind and partially sighted people at the heart of this. In terms of, could we spend the money doing other things, clearly any organisation needs to look at how it's spending its resources. One of the things that's very important for us is to fundraise and raise money. In order to do that, we need to be standing out, people need to be noticing us, people need to understand who we are and what we do. So really, this rebrand is very much an investment. It's making sure that we've got all of the right messages going out there, doing that in a very clear way that sticks in people's minds. And really, we will recoup that investment in the fundraising in future years.
So you look towards the future then, the next 150 years, with confidence thanks to this rebranding.
Yes, 150 years old this year. It's an amazing opportunity to both look back and look at the achievements that we've had, but also realise that there's still a long way to go. Blind and partially sighted people are still, there's lots of unemployment, employment rates are much lower than in the wider population. There are a lot of other barriers and things that we need to break down. So, there's a long way to go, but I really feel that this rebrand, this reintroduction of RNIB to the world will go a long way to making sure that we can break down those barriers even further in the future.
Sophie Castell, Director of Relationships with RNIB, thank you very much for talking with us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
My pleasure.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
This is the Daily Connect on RNIB Connect Radio, and it's time on a Friday for the Forum, an opportunity for us to discuss all kinds of topics. And with me this week to go through the topics are Ian Beverley and Joe Fishwick, who both work at RNIB. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So, we've got lots to talk about. We're going to be talking soon about disabled toilet access. That came up this week. We're also going to be talking about employment soon. But I think we're going to kick off with what we started with on the week here on the Daily Connect, and that was all about identity of visual impairment and how we identify ourselves. We put up a poll on Twitter, which came up with some rather interesting results around how people identify themselves. Do you consider yourself to be blind, partially sighted, visually impaired, or none of the above? And there are some contentious ones as well that come up from time to time. So, Joe, I'm going to let you go first on this one. Where do you stand on this whole issue of identity of someone living with a visual impairment?
For myself, because I've no sight at all, no light perception or anything, so I'm just plain and simple, I'm blind, and that works for me. It makes it quite easy to identify to people, when they ask about your sight. I'm blind, I've got nothing. But I do understand that it is a very difficult one, and that people do like to identify as different, different things. And I think it's all a matter of choice, really.
Yeah, because someone who's completely blind, you're right, that is almost the dictionary definition, isn't it, of someone who is blind, who can see nothing. But the truth is that out there in the world, the number of people who are actually blind, who can see nothing at all, it's a very small number. Very small number of people. In fact, a lot of people out there have got something, which might just be light perception, which might just be shadows, might be something, but not necessarily enough to be even be considered partially sighted. It's quite a contentious issue, Ian, isn't it?
It's very contentious, and I think it all, as you say, forms part of somebody's identity. For myself, I'm totally blind as well. No light perception. I suppose, in some ways, part of that exclusive club of a few people that don't have any. And to me, I'm blind, just straightforward as that. But it's just part of me instead of being the entire me. So whereas I recognise, identify with being blind, I don't see it as being my character, so to speak. So it's not, doesn't form my character. My character is formed by me, but as part of me, I'm blind.
Yeah, I was very actually at pains when we were discussing the poll this week and we were going to put it up on Twitter. I was actually at pains to make sure that it was said that as a person with a visual impairment, so person first, you know, which kind of ties into the whole new RNIB brand ethos, which is see the person, not the sight loss. That's quite important, isn't it, that we get to that point, Jo?
It is very important. As Ian rightly said, it's just a part of who you are, isn't it? It doesn't, it's your personality and who you are and what you do that is you as a person, and just being blind just happens to be a part of that.
So, you know, it's interesting, both of you have kind of, that's it, you're both blind and that's it, you know, because medically, realistically, practically, all of those things, that's the way you see it. It's interesting for someone like me because I've got some vision, but I call it, some people call it useful vision, some people would call it that. I would call it useless vision because it doesn't really do much for me. But I don't fall into the camp of blind because I've got some vision. So I am partially sighted, but I don't know if I'd call myself that. I don't know. And visually impaired comes up as well. And the other one is sight loss. And that was actually one of the terms which I think blind people don't like the most, because there are a lot of people out there who've had vision loss for a long time. So they've never really lost anything. That's another issue, isn't it? It's finding the right term. And one does not fit all.
I think there's a certain amount of political correctness around this, in the sense where people are generally afraid to call something the wrong way, so to speak. So I know, for a long time it was visually impaired because people were afraid to offend what they would consider as offend of calling somebody blind. And I think it's been trying to find a term that kind of meets the sensitivity of those who feel very, very sensitive about giving something a term. Does that, if that makes any sense?
Who are you thinking about? Are you talking here about the sighted community? Or,
yes, I am. I think in general, I mean, it's difficult to generalise. I wouldn't want to sort of say tar everybody with the same brush, but you do tend to get certain people amongst them who will get very, very sensitive about it. You know, it's generally things like, as I say, I use the term political correctness, but it's generally sort of a political kind of term where people are very, very sensitive about not offending. But yeah, whereas in the VI community, so to speak, it's, you know, people are comfortable with different terms and to different degrees.
I think you're right. I wonder, Joe, does that confuse the sighted community? I mean, we talk a lot about wanting to fit in, and we want the world to come to us to some degree, but we have to, I guess. We live in a sighted world. That's just the way it is. You know, with the greatest of respect to every charity and organisation and government programme in the world, you can never fully educate every single person on every single aspect of sight loss, because then you would have to do that for every disability that's going as well. So it's a very difficult thing. Do we complicate things by having a conversation about which term is best, blind, visually impaired, partially sighted?
I think, as I said before, it's a matter of choice and different. I know this from sort of the I talk, different people feel comfortable with different terms. I mean, there are a lot of people who've got a little bit of sight who still would call themselves blind, and I guess that's just because that makes it easier for them and that's what they feel comfortable with. And perhaps, as you rightly said, sometimes useful vision can be useless, can't it, depending on, you know, light conditions or what environment you're in. And so for somebody to call themselves blind, I know some people find that very irritating because they're like, well, you're not blind. But actually for that person, perhaps that's easier to identify as blind. So I do think it can be very, very contentious. And I think the public probably do get confused because there's all this thing visually impaired, vision impaired, you know, which is the right term. And as Ian said, you know, people don't want to offend generally. But as you said, you can't educate everybody. We try, but you just can't, because there'll always be people who just don't get it and don't understand. And that's life, isn't it? That's just the world that we know.
It is, yeah. I often say to people who say to me, people don't, those sighted folk, they don't understand visual impairment. And then I ask the question, yeah, but what do you know about multiple sclerosis or being deaf or, you know, living in a wheelchair? You know,
yeah,
it's a difficult one when it comes to this, because we cannot put every single problem in the world on sighted people. That's not fair. It's not their fault that they can see.
No.
But I think it's our responsibility, and then it comes down to our responsibility to educate and to make people aware as best as we can, because yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we can't possibly sort of then sort of put us into a situation, as you say, with someone with MS, someone who's hard of hearing, somebody, whatever, and we'd struggle as well. It's I think sometimes it's important to get that perspective on things when we're sort of feeling, you know, your sort of arms in the air and grumbling and moaning and all that. It's important to just stand back and just get that perspective on other things.
Ian, what do you do at RNIB? Come on, tell us the truth.
I'm a sight loss advisor.
Right,
so
okay.
I'm on the telephones. I'm one of the people who, when you call through to the helpline, and they'll if you want anything like benefits advice or anything really sort of to do with, when we're sort of talking about the term sight loss, then you're quite often put through to the sight loss advice team, and I'm one of those people.
What about you, Joe? What do you do?
I'm an assistive technology coordinator, so I'm part of the tech team. So it was my job to teach clients based at the Clifton Hotel in Tynmouth, which was one of the Vision Hotels, to, you know, the guests or people in the surrounding area, to teach them about technology, particularly mobile devices. And now I'm going out doing more engagement and partner work, so helping other organisations to do the kind of work that we've been doing.
So, if you don't mind me saying, Ian's in an office in Leeds at the moment, and you are in sunny Devon, Tynmouth in Devon. So that's why occasionally we'll hear the odd seagull in the background, which is just joyous. Joyous.
Yeah, you might think it's joyous, but when you live here, it does get to be a bit of a pain, I have to say.
Yeah, I just don't like them stealing my chips, but then I suppose I just shouldn't eat them outside. Right, well, look, you both work for RNIB. You do fantastic jobs. I have to say, Joe, from your perspective, you know, there may be a job going at Tech Talk soon if I don't buck myself up. So, you know, you might have a show to do on Tech Talk if you want, on technology issues. Especially where I'm going. But let's talk about employment, because Ian, for you, and if you don't mind me saying this, you and I have been in contact for several years. You used to listen to me on the Breakfast Show when I was on, which was a good few years back now. And in fact, you were with me from almost the very beginning. I remember you getting in touch, and I remember you telling me the story as we sort of went along through the years of trying to get back into employment. And for you, I think it's fair to say it was not an easy road.
It wasn't. I mean, there were several things going on at once in my life at that time anyway, but I just to flex on the story, it was 10 years ago now where I was made redundant from a previous employer. And then I had 2 years. It seemed longer at the time of trying to get back into work. And one of the biggest hurdles of doing that was actually dealing with the job centre and the DWP, and the hurdles that they kind of put in your way to try and sort of take advantage of the opportunities that may be more available to other people. So it was, and it was a case of trying to identify opportunities, applying, going through the the whole thing's to do with that. Interviews, rejections, interviews, rejections, keeping the motivation going, trying to seek more opportunities and eventually getting there. One of the biggest things that did it for me was trying, in terms of identifying the opportunities, was volunteering. And trying to put myself into positions where, you know, where opportunities could come. So it was lucky I'd moved halfway across the country back up north, and I was lucky to get into a volunteering opportunity that then led to a job.
And let's not play this down by any stretch, Ian. I mean, you went through literally hundreds of applications, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. I could say I got writer's cramp, but I don't write. I was using typing and
keyboard
things like
cramp,
that.
Yeah.
Keyboard cramp, that's what I say. But it's literally lots and lots of applications. I mean, yeah, it was great practice at that, but on the serious side of it, you could see where people do get dispirited. It is a very dispiriting thing to be putting in lots of applications. Lots of them you knew you were qualified for and you had the experience in doing, but then either not getting recognition of the application or going through an interview process where then to sort of say you weren't the right person for the job. You may not have been, but it's the whole rejection thing that you understand that puts many, many people off in that battle in trying to get into employment.
Joe, let me come to you. Tell me through your story of getting into employment and how you got to where you are today.
Oh, crikey, how long have you got?
Three minutes.
So I am in my first ever job, first ever paid job.
This job you're in now?
Yeah, wow. I'm in my 40s. I struggled all my life. I kept going back to college, retraining. The one thing I would say is just don't give up. You can't give up, because I'm proof, if proof were needed, that it is possible. And, you know, it can take a long time. How I got this job, I started volunteering up at the Clifton Hotel, sort of proofreading Braille, doing Braille for them, showing guests around the hotel who were visually impaired, that kind of thing, doing some visual awareness training for new staff members. And there was a job advertised for the assistive tech coordinator. And the manager said to me, why don't you go for it? And I went, don't be daft. Nobody will employ me. I've never had a job. And she went, come on, Joe. She said, excuse the pun, but you could do it with your eyes shut. So I went for it and I got it. And so I think just doing that whole volunteering thing, like Ian said, is a foot in the door, gets you known, shows that you're enthusiastic and that you want to be doing something. And sometimes it can just be the right place at the right time.
I think that certainly seems to be the case with a lot of these experiences I've heard, because I've equally got a friend of mine who has volunteered so much in the past few years, and he still can't get a job no matter how hard he tries, because they keep telling him, but you need paid experience of this to be able to show that you can do it, which is just nonsense. I wonder though, is it the case from you guys and your experiences, is it the employers that cause the problem? Do they just put up barriers for themselves? Maybe not obvious, but maybe subtly. They say, well, you know, this person can't really do the job, or we don't want to employ this person because we don't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
Was that your experience, Ian?
Yes, definitely. I think that is the key factor in all of this. And I think this is where, and I know I've said to you on many occasions, it's where it's being missed. I know there's a various amounts of employer engagement going on with different organisations, but so much politically, the emphasis is put on the individual, that it's the individual's fault they're not working, and it's the individual who, you know, should be doing this, doing that, doing the other. But unless you've got the environment there that's fair and that can give people an equal chance to get in and take away that fear and that misunderstanding and that misconception, then you are fighting a battle. And I feel strongly that a lot of emphasis should be put on awareness and also sort of educating, constantly educating employers, giving them the opportunity, giving them the incentive, And then I feel things will then start to get better. But until then, you know, it's a constant battle. So things like volunteering and the other things we've talked about, then that has to be the way at the moment until, you know, the awareness of employers gets better.
Joe?
I think employers are scared sometimes, and I think it's the whole, will it cost us money because you might need equipment? And I think the whole access to work thing is a problem, to be honest, because it's such a complex system. Very hard to, you know, get that support. But also I think people need educating so that when they do perhaps get an interview, that they can say to an employer, well, actually, you know, there is help out there, there's support for me to, you know, come into this business, come into this organisation, and be a fully functioning member of the team. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? People have this fear of disability, I guess, and think, oh, well, you know, perhaps you're not going to be able to do the full job. And it's having that support to explain to employers that you might have to do things slightly differently. It might take slightly longer in some instances, but, you know, you can still be a full member of a team, yeah, of an organisation.
Mm. Well, we could talk about this all day. I'm sure it's a huge topic, and one we will definitely be coming back to. I want to hear more people's views on this because, you know, I think we also maybe need to challenge business more. And, you know, that's one thing with this programme. I want to try and get more people on from business to talk as well. And maybe I'd love to hear someone explain to me from an employer perspective, why they wouldn't employ a blind person. What is the fear? You know, that's what I'd love to know.
Yeah.
What is that fear that you've got, and why can't that be overcome?
I think because sight is such an instant thing to people. I think it goes down to the basics of people's fear of losing sight is bigger. It's probably one of the biggest things. I think there's been a lot of research done on this in terms of what scares you most and what is your biggest fear. I think in many instances for many people have ranked losing their sight as one of the highest things. You know, it's even more than getting, you know, a very, very severe illness, for instance. So as an instant means of communication, people losing that, then they just fear they've lost everything, and hence why you've got this general fear.
And it is a low incidence disability, isn't it, compared to other disabilities. I didn't realise until I was at an event a couple of years ago, and a lady did a talk about different disabilities, and, you know, visual impairment or blindness is rare, if you will, compared to other disabilities. And so, although, you know, you see people with guide dogs, long canes, symbol canes around, but in some areas people will never have seen somebody who is blind or partially sighted.
First of all, before we get to disabled toilets, because that's a big topic this week, but I want to just first mention VI Talk, which is a forum which I kind of stumbled across a while back and have kind of fallen in love with. I just love getting involved in conversation, but listening to and reading a lot of the time, just listening to people's views on different things. And, you know, that's what the show's about. Basically, I'm a nosy person. That's ultimately what it is. Joe, you're the chair. We found this out earlier. You're the chair of VI Talk. So tell us in a nutshell, or I just explained it, but what is it?
Okay, so VI Talk started as a voluntary group in January 2014. And became a charity, specifically a CIO, charitable incorporated organisation, in February 2016. Ian was instrumental in that as well. There are four trustees, and we've got seven groups on Facebook for various things: arts and crafts, music, travel, book club, sports, main group, and resources. We also do interviews with lots of different people, and we also have blogs, which are run by Ian. And we have a website, and we're on Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram and just everywhere, really. So if you search for VI Talk, you'll find us, and come and join us, because it's good fun, although it isn't all of the time, I have to say. It can get a bit feisty, but, you know.
That's not a bad thing, though. I mean, you know, it's real life, isn't it? That's the way it goes. And let's be honest, when you get to social media, anything goes.
Absolutely.
What about the podcasting side, Ian? Because you do a bit of that as well, don't you?
No, I'm just responsible for the blog. But Joe's on the podcasting.
Oh, you right? Okay, right. Okay, so it's the other way around.
That's fine. No, you're fine.
So Joe does. So basically, what we thought, Joe does all the work, Ian, and then you just take the glory.
yeah. Well, that's what just going along for the ride. That's the one. Yeah.
So what kind of podcasts are you doing? Is it just general people's comments on things, or do they have themes? How does it work?
So the blogs are put into podcasts, so Ian is part of that. He writes it, but we have a volunteer reader who puts those into audio for us, which is great.
Right, okay.
We interview visually impaired people, so if they've got a story to tell, we're happy to let them tell it. So it could be a musician, a performer, it could be somebody who's just passionate about something. It could just be somebody telling their journey, you know, about through sight loss. It could be a job that they do, an organisation that they work for. We do our countdown to Sight Village every year, so we interview as many of the exhibitors from Sight Village as possible so that people who perhaps can't attend the exhibition can still get a flavour of what's out there. So yeah, anything goes really. We're just in the process of sorting out interviewing a blind photographer who's in America. And also a young lady who's popped up on VI Talk who has just been in an episode of Doctors, and it's a case of a visually impaired person actually playing the part of a visually impaired person, which is always really good to hear.
Oh, yeah, I was reading that. Was that Claire? Was it Claire?
Claire posted it. It's actually Grace, who's the
Grace.
Actress.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to be interviewing Grace, hopefully, very soon.
Right, okay. No, I find it a great forum to read on Facebook. That's where I go to. And I don't contribute a heck of a lot, if I'm honest, but I like to read what people are saying and thinking, because, you know, it is my job to be interested in this, but it's kind of my life as well. So, you know, this is a really interesting thing. And I think a lot of people probably consume it in that way. I know a lot of people communicate, but I think sometimes just having a place to go when you read something and you kind of smile to yourself and say, that happens to you as well, that's good to know. That's what I like about it. So, no, it's great. So do check out VI Talk. But interestingly, when I mentioned the podcast there, Joe, you do the interviews, and one interview you did was with the guys from Roommate, Helen and Steve Hoyler, who were on the show this week on the Daily Connect. I'd interviewed them a while back to talk about Roommate. It's a system which is going into disabled toilets that lets a blind person know where everything is when you walk in. You know, it's like, right, so the sink is at 12 o'clock and the toilets or whatever. And it's a kind of system that helps you navigate your way around. You know, I'll come to you first on this.
Okay.
What's your thoughts on this system?
I'm sort of a bit sort of sat on the fence about it, because whereas I probably wouldn't massively benefit from it. I wouldn't sit, you know, when I went to a toilet, I'm usually fairly adept at trying to find where things are and having things explained to me. Usually when you want to go into the toilet, you want to go to the toilet. However, I think the idea is wonderful. For many people, certainly orientation wise, certainly in terms of maybe not mixing, say, the chain or the flusher up with the alarm, for instance, that would be, you know, a very, very good thing. But also, I think it would be very good for not just for VI people, but I think for many sighted people as well, because I've known people go into disabled loos in places, not realise what they're pressing, and ended up pressing the alarm and setting all sorts kinds of emergencies off. So in terms of its general benefit, I think it's wider than maybe just the VI community.
Now, Joe, you interviewed them, as I say. You interviewed Helen and Steve for VI Talk. What was your impression of Roommate?
I did, and I think, like Ian, I'm very much sort of, my orientation skills aren't too bad, so when I go into a disabled toilet, I'm okay, really, generally speaking. However, the other week I did go into a toilet and it had the old-fashioned chain that, you know, hangs down, and I'm thinking, you know, you're looking around for the flush thinking, where the heck is this? And then you realise that it's an old-fashioned toilet, you know, and it's not the way you would expect it to be. So on that occasion, it probably would have been quite helpful, would have saved me time faffing about. I think for some people, perhaps, who are new to visual impairment, that it's a, you know, it's very useful for them. And not everybody has good orientation skills, you know, not everybody is quite as confident or able to, you know, navigate around a room and work out where things are. So I think it's, again, it's all about choice. On VI Talk, it has been noted that people would like this same principle, but in other places. Which is, it's that technology, isn't it? But would it be useful? Could it be expanded to, you know, to other ideas?
I mean,
I'll tell you where it would be useful would be on trains.
Yes,
with disabled toilets or whatever toilets on the train, because, you know, that could be have even more dire consequences if you end up pressing the wrong button.
Yeah, it's not, well, on a train, it's less to do with where is the toilet pan and more where is the toilet itself, isn't it? You know, it's like, where is the thing? And obviously, I mean, you can't go too far wrong on a train because you only are really two ways you can go. But, you know, you don't want to spend your life trying to find the toilet. You know, a trip from Glasgow to London takes what feels like 5 minutes because all you've been doing is looking for a toilet in that period of time. but it is. But, you know, it's the same in shops. You go into a shop and where is the checkout? And, you know, I would love to see this kind of technology developed into some kind of app. And I know we're kind of going down this route. I mean, you guys know I'm a tech geek, so I'm interested in all this stuff. But I do think there comes a time where our technology should start to help guide us about. And this would be massively beneficial to mainstream people as well. It doesn't have to be just for blind people. I mean, I think anybody walks into a store these days, it's so big. Where is the thing I'm looking for? Oh, it's over there. Right, okay. And have that audibly or visually or whatever on an app would be incredible. So this technology has got great potential. And I think there are some people who are very quick to jump on these things and say, well, blind people should be more independent. But that's not always, it's not always as simple as that, is it?
No. The environment's always changing. Mm. And you need something and things to adapt and change with that environment. You know, there's apps now. I'm hopefully going to pronounce this right. Is it Aira or something?
Aira,
that's it. Mm. Being trialled here in the UK. I think that's huge potential in terms of using technology to help guide through particular situations. And we all want to be independent and we all want to have that. But we've got to realise that, you know, with the constantly changing environments and the way, you know, things like city centres are becoming even busier, then sort of using technology to get around that and to get through it is an advantage. I think we should sort of welcome that from that perspective.
I think we should, just on the Aira point, just so people are aware of what we're talking about, these are glasses with a camera in them which let you connect to a human. The assistant essentially can see what you're seeing through your glasses and guide you around or give you information, and it sounds like a fantastic service. It's really taken the US by storm. It's been trialled in the UK. It's been launched in other countries like New Zealand and Canada, but it's due to arrive here hopefully quite soon. I think a lot of us are hoping sooner, because it sounds like a really great thing. I mean, it almost sounds like that system and a guide dog would be the perfect combination. You've got your mobility sorted and you've got, you know, someone with you at all times, essentially. But aside that, you know, away from the tech side of this, I mean, is it a case that perhaps, you know, Steve Hoyler, who, you know, was the kind of brainchild of this, I guess, because of his own experiences, he talked about having real problems when he was going to the bathroom, especially when he was going to a public, instead of maybe a disabled toilet, a public toilet. You know, and I know it's not the most pleasant discussion to have in the world, but, you know, this is reality. This is life. These challenges do come up for us. You know, having lost vision later in life does mean that your whole world has changed around you and you've got a heck of a lot to get used to. Whereas if you've had blindness your whole life, well, you're far further forward. Or even if you've lost your sight when you're younger, you've still had more time to get used to it. I think that's maybe where this kind of technology comes in and maybe, you know, holds its own, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think so. I think when we've had, I mean, I was born with a sight problem, which gradually deteriorated. So you know, from a very young age, I was used to having little or no sight, whereas losing your sight, you know, as an adult must be terrifying. Absolutely must. And I just can't begin to imagine. I've spoken to people within my job who, you know, they say they went into an optician's for a routine eye test and they're told that actually when you leave here, you shouldn't drive again. And that must be terrifying. It must be so scary. And I think we forget, as people who've experienced this all our lives, that we need to be a little bit more empathic and we need to be a bit more tolerant of people who are experiencing it for the first time.
Guys, I could talk to you guys all day. You need to come back.
Okay.
You need to come back on some point because this has been such good fun. Thank you so much for coming on the forum today. And everybody, check out VI Talk. It is brilliant. Ian Definitely. And Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Time now to find out about the new RNIB quick poll, which is available right now. Natalie Spodeska is here to tell us all about it. Hi, Natalie.
Hello there.
Hello, yes, welcome along. How are you this week, Natalie? How's your week been?
Yeah, not too bad despite the drizzle rain all day today, but I'm feeling chipper despite it.
Do you know what, I have to say, I get a little bit excited when I see rain and a bit of cold. I don't know, it makes me feel British again.
I do like the winter months rather than the summer months, actually, because I like getting cosy and warm. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm a bit like that too.
Get some good Netflix on. Oh, marvellous.
Duvet on the sofa and box sets, yeah.
Oh, it sounds like heaven. I wish I was there now. Right, listen, we're talking about the quick poll today, and it's back once again. This time it's all about those dockless bikes we've been talking about.
Yeah. I heard you on the podcast yesterday talking with Kirsty James, wasn't it?
That's so, right.
Yeah, good timing because we've been running the poll on dockless bikes. It's been going a week, so we've got another week left. So, if you want to have your chance to give your opinion and have your say, tell us a bit about your experience with dockless bikes, whether you've come across them, then now's the time to have a look.
These seem to be everywhere now. I mean, there was a time when you started to see them appearing. I always remember them starting off, I guess, with the Boris bikes in London. And then around the country, these schemes have popped up where these bikes have become available. And one of the issues, it seems, is that they're clearly very cheap to hire because people are just leaving them lying around. They're not caring about any fine that comes along with leaving them. Or maybe that's the idea of them. I don't really understand these things. I don't know why you would set up a system where you can just leave bikes anywhere in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not Amsterdam, you know.
We're not that cultured.
No. Well, we're certainly proving that.
Not yet. No, it confuses me a little bit. I haven't seen them in my city. I'm in Nottingham, but I've come across them in Peterborough where the RNIB offices are because I've walked past a few of them and but they're actually docked in a shed.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, but I've not seen any. Although a friend did have one in his front garden. In Norfolk, so that doesn't sound too good.
No, you don't want. Well, I mean, if it's nice if it's a free bike, but it's not a free bike, you know, it's someone else's property. And you know, we heard Kirsty talking about an experience of someone finding one of these at the top of a flight of stairs outside. And you think, you know, someone walking along with a guide dog, okay, the guide dog would navigate around it, someone with a white cane wouldn't. You know, they walk right into that, and you know, you can only imagine what might happen then.
Yeah, it's just like street litter, isn't it? It just clutters up, blocks ways, and they're not obviously light things. If they fall over, they're not going to hurt
bikes.
Somebody, aren't they?
Yeah. So the quick poll's up. How long is the poll up for?
The polls are open for 2 weeks, so we're in the middle of that 2 week now. So it'll close next sort of Tuesday, Wednesday, probably Tuesday night, and I'll do all the analysis and look at the results the following day. So we just wanted to kind of, I think where it's come from is, obviously there's lots of discussions going on about it generally anyway, but the campaigns team are obviously looking at it as well. And the campaigns officer in the Northwest who got in touch with me about it, wanted me to run it for her, was kind of saying that she'd had conversations with people and there's a very split sort of decision about where people thought they should be storing these bikes. Obviously, there's the docking stations, if you want to call them that. But where best to place them when they're not being left there. So there was a conversation around, should they be left by a side of a building away from the edge of the curb, or should they be left somewhere else? And she was finding it was a very split conversation. There was lots of different opinions different experiences about whether people had fallen over them or kind of ran into them or got their cane stuck in them. And so she wanted to also know if anyone had that experience. So I think it's going to be useful because it doesn't matter if you haven't actually come across one, but we'd like to have your opinion about what you think, you know, where they should be stored and what you think we should be doing with them, so that the campaigns team can then sort of use this to talk to sort of the wider public and kind of share our knowledge with those decision makers and try and kind of improve I guess, public awareness of what a pest these could be or are at the moment. So, yeah, you're very useful to kind of get involved. If you've got 2 minutes, it takes less than that, just to kind of click a few buttons and give us your opinion.
I think that's a good point you make, though, about, you know, it doesn't matter whether in your area or not, because they could be coming to your area. And if they do, then you want to be prepared for it. And there needs to be some rules around how these things are governed, or how, you know, where people put them. Mm. I think also just raising awareness to people in general. I mean, I made the comment on the show the other day that, you know, I feel people who use bikes are generally quite socially responsible people. You know, they want to get fit, perhaps, or they want to just not drive a car. You know, so can we be a bit more socially responsible and not just leave them in the paths of other people? It seems pretty obvious, I guess. But then, of course, it's not always about that. Someone could leave it propped up against a building and then it falls over when the person goes away. So it is about where these things go. So, yeah, really good poll. Where do people find it?
So if you you can Google search or look on the RNIB Connect Radio homepage. The link is on there and it'll take you straight through to the survey.
Brilliant. Natalie, have a great weekend.
Thank you. See you soon.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
And as it's Friday on the Daily Connect, it's time for this with Chris.
The Daily Connect.
Time indeed for something for the weekend. And we've got a great selection for you today from Netflix, the cinema, AD Theatre, and just one for Stephen Scott. There's some music as well. But starting with Netflix, Netflix released the second series of their Netflix original programme, a satire on a lot of these murder documentary specials or podcasts, such as S-Town and Serial. It's called American Vandal, now in its second series.
In April of 2016, Sam Eklund and I began shooting American Vandal. The response has been incredible. But with all this attention came a lot of pressure on what kind of a case to take on next.
I'm contacting you because we have a vandal.
I look at my phone and I got tagged in a video.
This guy wanted an audience.
He was taunting us.
Milk, milk, lemonade, around the corner, poo emojis made.
Before it was all over, it had a name. The Brownout.
So American Vandal Season 2 is about to hit screens with a whole new mystery to be explored in this satirical comedy. Now, the first series was about rude graffiti, and as you could maybe pick up from that, the second series is about some rude bodily functions. Now, it seems juvenile, and in a lot of instances it is quite juvenile, but they get the machinations of these shows like Making a Murderer and Serial and S-Town and The Staircase down so well that the satire actually pays off. If you've not checked out the first series, well, now would be a good time to do so, as the second series is available, and as we all know, the AD on Netflix is currently second to none. Jumping now to the cinema, and there's two big releases. There's something all actiony and there's something a bit more romantic, but we're starting with the action, and The Predator is released. A young boy accidentally triggers the universe's most lethal hunter's return to Earth. Only a ragtag crew of ex-soldiers and a disgruntled science teacher can prevent the end of the human race.
Predators just don't sit around making hats out of rib cages. They conquered space. But that's not what's on the horizon.
Should I be worried?
Riley.
I think you know what is on the ship. The ultimate predators.
Light him up!
We may die.
We're still here. So come and get us.
So this is the fourth official Predator film. Of course, the Predators have shown up in Aliens vs. Predator and a few other series. But this one is a direct sequel to Robert Rodriguez's Predators, which didn't do very well. Predator and Predator 2 did much better. But this is Shane Black. Now, interestingly, Shane Black has gone on to have a great career. He wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, as well as Iron Man 3 and The Good Guys. But his career actually started as an actor in the original Predator film, and he's always wanted to return to it. So has he done the franchise justice? Well, check it out at the cinemas. It's already available. You could go this afternoon if you fancied it and see The Predator. Check your local cinemas for AD listings across the country. To AD Theatre now, and there's a great show coming to the Donmar Warehouse in London. It's called The Aristocrats. It's playing tomorrow at 2:30 p.m., but there's a touch tour starting at 1 o'clock. Ballybeg Hall once played host to grand balls, musical evenings and tennis parties. Its rooms busy, bursting with painters, poets and politicians, and presiding over it all, the imposing figure of Judge O'Donnell. Now, on the eve of a wedding, the O'Donnell children return to their ancestral home to find that the rot has set in. Now, the great thing about the Aristocrats at the Donmar Warehouse in London tomorrow is that if you require a companion to attend the Donmar, their ticket will be free. Young and free tickets are available for this performance for those under 25 and for anyone who requires a companion. Just call the box office for details. Also coming to Dublin as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival is My Dad's Blind. Anna Shields McNamee grew up with her dad who couldn't see. For her, it was nothing out of the ordinary, yet for others, her dad would be either classed as a hero or treated as a child. Inspired by her own life, Anna wrote a play that breaks down boundaries and challenges the infantilization of people with disabilities. But why would I tell you about the show when we've got Anna herself? Here's Anna Shields McNamee inviting you to see her play, My Dad's Blind.
Hi, I'm Anna Shields McNamee, and I'm doing a show for the Dublin Fringe Festival called My Dad's Blind. It's about a father-daughter relationship and how they function in a sighted world with a blind parent. It's on from the 18th to the 22nd of September in the Project Arts Centre upstairs in Dublin. And I'd love you to come and see it.
So that's what's happening in AD Theatre across the country. But I didn't want to leave Something for the Weekend this weekend without, of course, drawing attention to an album release that I know that Stephen Scott will want to get his grubby little hands on. Yes, Carrie Underwood has released her sixth studio album. It's called Cry Pretty. And here is the title and lead-off single. You can play. Say it's okay, you can pretty smile and just walk away, pretty much take your. Carrie said, at this point in my career, I feel stronger and more creative than ever. I think you can hear that in this new album. It's emotional, it's soulful, it's real, and we also have some fun on there too. I hope everyone loves it as much as I have loved making it. Carrie actually served as a producer on this album, so I'm sure you'll be hearing a little bit about it on Real Country as the weeks come in. So that's it for another Something for the Weekend, but whatever your weekend plans are, have a great time and a very warm weekend to you.
I have no idea why he thinks I would like that. Yes, of course I do. It's brilliant. It's Carrie Underwood. And yes, you will definitely hear more of her on Real Country coming up. But that is it for the Daily Connect podcast for the week. Thank you so much for downloading. We're back on Monday on the podcast from 5 as always, and on air live from 10 till 12 on RNIB Connect Radio, Freeview Channel 730, and online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk, as well as on your smart speaker. You can get us by saying play RNIB Connect Radio. Have a great weekend. The Daily Connect Podcast.